Our eyes have seen the gory and the bloody White House fight.
And we saw people of color back the left and not the right.
If we can't appeal to voters who aren't elderly and white,
then we could soon be gone. Glory, glory, how they do it. Things are bad, the voters knew it. What's the Spanish word for blue it? Could this be our swan song?
We have long held our convictions. It's our views we must reshape.
Now the Democrats are iPods and we're more like 8-track tape.
Let's agree that men should never, ever share their thoughts on rape.
Just what was Akin on? We have blocked Barack's agenda. We cannot do that again.
4 more years of gridlock and they'll notify our next of kin.
Let's deny Barack a third term. That is something
we could win.
I'm sure we can't go wrong.
Glory, glory to our nation. We could face obliteration. Let us try cooperation.
Nah.
And that we agree.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice, and you can hear us at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. If you're just joining us, we're listening to How Americans Fail Their Soldiers and Their Country with Andrew Basevich.
Now, I use him in the book. I said that he's the originator of what I call Smedley's syndrome, which is the tendency of at least some senior military officers to change their minds when they take off their uniform and to suddenly speak truths that when they were still on active duty, they would have not spoken. He's an example of that. I cite some other examples of that. But I really do that in order to cite the most recent example, and that is General William McChrystal.
Stanley McChrystal.
Excuse me, General Stanley McChrystal. That Stanley McChrystal, famous as the commander of Special Operations Forces in the Iraq War, famous as somebody who then became the commander in Afghanistan, only to be fired after about a year on the job. Once he retired, he came out and announced that he thought that the all-volunteer force was a bad idea.
Let's let him speak for himself at an Aspen Ideas conference in 2012 on this subject.
My guess is we're not going to get a draft through. But what is your take on some sort of mandatory national service?
I am becoming a little bit more extreme on this each year. Right now, I think everybody 56 years old and younger ought to have to serve 2 years. I'm 57. What I really believe is I think we need national service, and I think you need it either at the conclusion of high school or university.
People cheered that.
They did.
You think they meant it?
I don't know. I agree with General McChrystal. But I'm curious why he waited until he was no longer on active duty to announce his support for national service. Had he done that when he was a serving four-star general, that would have been interesting. That might have triggered a very interesting conversation. Now he's a retired four-star, and he goes out to Aspen, and he spouts off, and he gets polite applause, but I don't think anybody really much cares what he has to say any longer. That's Smedley's syndrome in action. If you had this important insight, why didn't you share it with us when you actually could have done something about it?
Well, just for kicks, why don't I ask you the same question? You spent 23 years in the service. Why didn't you do something about the way you felt about the book here says breach of trust when you were in the service. You stayed 23 years.
Yeah, and a fair question. And I think the answer is my own short-sightedness, that through the time when I was serving into the early 1990s, I was not able to discern the snares that this reliance on a standing army was going to get us in. Now, again, going back to my time of serving in the latter part of the Cold War, when the army in which I served was rebuilding from the catastrophe of Vietnam, and the rebuilding in many respects was a great success in terms of better level of training, better quality soldiers, better discipline, higher morale, better esprit. So that by the time I got to the latter part of my career in the 1980s and into the 1990s, it was not difficult to command a unit in the sense that you had these wonderful people who really wanted to soldier. That's the army I left in 1992. Now, what didn't I see that I wish in retrospect I had seen? Well, what I didn't see that was that once the Cold War ended, both some politicians and some generals would work hard to find ways to put this wonderful army to work. When deterring the Soviet Union was no longer the principal task confronting the Pentagon, but when all this capacity was available, people in the Pentagon, people in the White House, people in the State Department sat down and thought real hard about, well, what can we do with this capacity? And they needed to find something to do with it in order to justify its continued existence. And so this led to the emergence of some very pernicious ideas. One of those pernicious ideas was the notion that technology can enable us to win wars quickly and neatly with great levels of assurance. Another pernicious idea is the notion that we should be using these forces to project American power rather than to defend ourselves and defend our allies.
I just want to interrupt a second. This is only 30 seconds, and it's right about the time that you got out of the service, and it's the defense spending cuts discussion in the Congress, and this is former Chief of Staff of the Army, General Gordon Sullivan. This is going to say some of the same things you have, but this is 1992.
Previously, we trained for attrition warfare with structured organizations backed up by the mobilized potential of this nation. Today, we train for decisive victory in tailorable organizations of mixed components. The power of the microprocessor, the microchip, leverages our human potential. Yesterday, mass was the key to warfare. Today, precision is the key to warfare. Controlling the dimensions of speed, space, and time, applying decisive combat power at the critical point.
When you see him say that today, this is, 21 years later, what do you think he would say today about what he said then?
Well, I hope he would say, gosh, I was naive. Gosh, I got it wrong. And how I regret that. I mean, the clip we just saw was a nice succinct expression of that conception of warfare that I tried to describe a little while ago. And that conception of warfare informed people's expectations for how the Iraq War was supposed to go. Guess what? It didn't. We didn't win a decisive victory. And what we ended up with is a protracted war that Sullivan's army was not properly trained for and not properly sized for. That's crucial. Sullivan says mass doesn't matter. Well, in Iraq and Afghanistan, mass does matter in the sense that if you're going to be able to pacify these countries, it's going to require a substantial number of soldiers to do that. But having abandoned our tradition of the citizen soldier in the wake of Vietnam, having embraced this model of a standing army, of professionals, we found ourselves with no easy way to expand the force in order to take on this mission that Sullivan was not able to anticipate. With what consequences? Well, among the consequences, number one, repeated combat tours, sending people back again and again and again with terribly adverse effects on their well-being. And also, in an effort to sort of make up for this gap between too much war, not enough warriors, insert contractors into that gap. Basically, privatize warfare to a very considerable extent turning over to private contractors who are in the business to make money, turning over to them tasks that normally would have been allotted to soldiers, and with incredible waste.
Axis Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. And now, back to How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country with Andrew Basevit.
Where, you might say, where are the American people in all this? Well, the American people are on the sidelines. They're in the grandstands. They're cheering. They're putting bumper stickers on their cars saying support the troops. But in a substantive sense, they are disengaged. They're disengaged from their army. They're disengaged from war itself. And the consequences didn't produce victory. And haven't produced any substantial benefits for the country. I would argue, I try to argue in the book, that in fact, this reliance on a professional army that is disengaged from the people, that permits officials in Washington to engage in unnecessary wars, has depleted American power. The earlier clip said that President Obama says that people who say that we're in decline don't know what they're talking about. Well, I take issue with the president. I mean, I think there's plentiful evidence that the country is in serious trouble. There are lots of reasons why we're in serious trouble. One of the reasons we're in serious trouble is that we have developed this proclivity for wars, this compulsion to use force in ways that don't produce positive outcomes. And there's a lot of, considerable amount of thinking that really ought to be happening in Washington to try to figure out how we got in this mess and how we got out. That's why one of the things that just outrages me is the fact that the inclination in Washington, indulged by the American people, is to forget about the failures, to not think about, to not try to identify the serious lessons of the Iraq War. Frankly, not even to identify the serious explanations for why 9/11 happened. It's very disturbing.
What were the circumstances that your son lost his life in Iraq?
Well, I've made it a policy not to talk about that, and it only because it seems to me that these are private matters, and we're better off just letting them stay that way.
But isn't that a factor in the way you feel about all this?
Well, I imagine it is. And if prior to May 13th of 2007, I'd been a gung-ho supporter of the war, and on the day after I became a war critic, then you might say it had a decisive impact. But the truth is, I was a critic of the war before my son was killed. And of course, how could something like that not affect one's outlook? But I don't think that... I don't think that it had a decisive effect.
Well, the kind of the reason I brought it up is that you told us when we started this discussion that you sat there in the food hall at the mess hall. I'm sorry, at West Point, and they would. I mean, I wanted to ask you, why would they announce the number of West Point grads that had been killed in Vietnam?
They were not announcing the number; they were announcing the names.
The name. Well, why would they do that though? When you're sitting there training to go to war. What was the point?
Well, nobody explained to me what the point was, but I would think that the point would be to is an act of homage, that here is someone who once marched in your ranks. That person has now forfeited his life for his country. Let us at least acknowledge that has happened. In retrospect, I don't find it inappropriate. In retrospect, I think it was more than appropriate.
Didn't even mean to imply it was inappropriate, but it would be interesting to know what the impact that had on you. You're sitting there having a meal, and all of a sudden, you know, Tom Smith dies in Vietnam. But go move ahead to your son dying. Most Americans didn't see anybody in Iraq or Afghanistan get wounded or killed. And there were 6,500, I think, both in Iraq and Afghanistan total killed, and another 7,000 that were wounded. How much did that have as an impact versus the Vietnam, where there was a draft, on the American people?
This is something that I write about in this book, and quite frankly, I've tried to insert into previous books, that the unintended consequence of abandoning the tradition of the citizen soldier and instituting our so-called all-volunteer army, misnamed our professional army, the unintended consequence was to allow a separation between the American people and the American military to occur, a gap. And one manifestation of that gap is that, if we take the complaint of the Occupy Wall Street, you know, it's the 1%. The rich people, the 1%, are exploiting the 99%. Well, when it comes to war, we have the reverse. We have the 99% exploiting the 1%. The 1% who serve, who are sent to these wars, many of which should not be fought, none of which are being won. The 1% bears the burden of service and sacrifice, and the other 99% watch. And that is not democratic, and I think it is profoundly immoral. And I think it's going to continue to be the case as long as we maintain this all-volunteer force. And the solution is the solution that General McChrystal identified, I think, to institute a program of national service in which all will serve, all able-bodied 18-year-olds will serve, some of them serving in the military, others serving in other capacities, but all of them serving the country for a period of time. As a means to reconstitute a more vigorous definition of citizenship, and as a means to ensure that the army that we send is an army of the people, that is representative of a cross-section of the American people. I think that is something that needs to be part of our political debate.
I want you to watch this short 40-second clip of President George Bush talking about Tommy Franks, who was very much involved in the Iraq War, getting the Medal of Freedom, and he's sitting there with George Tenet and I think Don Rumsfeld, I'm not sure, but let's watch this and get your reaction to this.
The general likes to say that no plan ever survived the first contact with the enemy, but in Iraq, Tommy Franks' plan did. A force half the size of the force that won the Gulf War defeated Saddam Hussein's regime and reached Baghdad in less than a month, the fastest, longest armored advance in the history of American warfare. Today, the people of Iraq and Afghanistan are building a secure and permanent democratic future. One of the highest distinctions of history is to be called a liberator, and Tommy Franks will always carry that title.
The other person, I think, it was not Don Rumsfeld. He's probably in the audience, but it may have been Paul Wolfowitz. But anyway, the Medal of Freedom to Tommy Franks, what's your reaction to that?
Well, it's a travesty. I mean, the narrative of the Iraq war that the president just gave us was, to put it mildly, incomplete. Franks did succeed in toppling Saddam Hussein. But that was not sufficient. It was not sufficient to either achieve our political purposes or to provide deliverance to the Iraqi people. I mean, Iraq today is coming apart at the seams, with hundreds on a monthly basis, hundreds of Iraqis being killed by the renewed insurgency.
So the
barely makes the paper.
Whole thing was a waste of time, waste of money, waste of.
I think, well,
Americans?
You know, yeah, it was. I mean, I understand the response. You know, the world is a better place because Saddam Hussein is gone. I suppose that's true.
Were these men evil that got us involved in there? I pull evil out of the air, but I mean, how would you describe?
They were arrogant and they were naive. And it's hard to understand in a way, because you remember when the Republicans won the 2000 election. Well, part of the Republican critique of the Democrats during the Clinton era was that when the Democrat national security team was like amateur hour, and that what the Republicans portrayed themselves as the people who understand how the world works, and we were going to bring in these seasoned operators like Rumsfeld on a second tour, Secretary of Defense. Colin Powell becoming the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor. Heck, Dick Cheney was the Vice President. These were the people who supposedly understood how the world really worked and therefore could be trusted to make prudent and wise decisions. And that's why it's so hard to understand their arrogance and their naivete. But that's the label they will carry into history, and the label that Tommy Franks will carry will be incompetent.
Who's the last politician you thought knew what they were doing and you could vote for?
Well, I voted for Barack Obama twice, but I voted for Barack Obama because, you know, when you get to an election, it's either this guy or that guy, and it seemed to me that Obama was a preferable alternative. But in terms of the last president who I think deserves respect, I think I'd probably say I like Ike. Now, he had his own flaws and did some pretty stupid things in Iran, in Guatemala. He's the guy who sort of teed up the ball for John Kennedy when it came to the Bay of Pigs, which was foolish. But when you look at the 8 years of the overall, make an overall judgment of the 8 years of the Eisenhower presidency, he did pretty darn well.
You say that basically the Washington establishment, I wrote this down, says, quote, trust us, we know what we're doing, unquote.
Well, I think that that's the attitude I sense. And what I mean is this, that over the course of the Cold War and into the post-Cold War period, there emerged this notion that national security affairs, broadly speaking, was complex. And to be able to contribute to the making of national security policy, you need to acquire expertise. You need to be an insider. You have to have access to the classified administration. And if you buy that notion, then the role of the American people in the formulation of national security policy is basically to defer, to look to Washington for guidance. And it seems to me that if you look at the performance of our national security establishment, in particular, in the post-Cold War era, there's no justification for saying that somebody who has a high-ranking position in the Defense Department is any smarter than my late-departed Aunt Betty Lou, who lived her entire life in Morrison, Illinois. So I'd like to see Americans become a lot more willing to ask hard questions and to not defer. I don't see any signs that's going to happen. But I think that's what we need.
All right, now, ladies and gentlemen, I'll admit that there have been some problems in the White House. But there is one problem around here that is definitely going to get fixed. Here, buddy, here, boy. Come on, buddy.
Here he is. Hey, how's my buddy? Oh, no, wait. Hey, stop. Get off there. That's federal evidence. Oh, damn. Ladies and gentlemen, my buddy.
A great female I'll never get when that he-male takes me to the vet. 'Cause to be male, you need a full set. So never forget, you've gotta have parts. Getting neutered really smart. And don't apply to be a puppy intern. That's where the trouble starts. It won't be much fun. I'll feel testy when it's done. And doing this to any dog who's a mutt's totally nuts. No pun. They can't re-glue them or re-stick them. They'll be thrown out in a pan. Just last week I learned to lick them. Like they say, because I can. Places where I stick my nose will end up in the trash disposal. Oh, cruel, cruel fate. And I hear Hillary can't wait. When my puppy jewels are chopped on the block, she'll ask the doc to stay.
Hey, doc, you got a group rate?
And now for something completely different.